Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished colleagues and friends. The first slide I want to show you is the current taxonomy of our project, the quality control in preliminary examination. Currently, the program as you have it in front of you consists of the following sections. The first is the practice of preliminary examination, realities and constraints. And we have seven papers committed to this segment for the purposes of the conference and the subsequent anthology. Secondly, it is case studies or situation analysis. So we go from a focus on the institutional reality of preliminary examination to looking at specific situations where there has been preliminary examination. Thirdly, we have a segment on the normative framework of preliminary examination. So here, the legal questions, the legal analysis raising specific issues have been clustered together with seven committed papers, eight for the previous second segment. Fourthly, we have a combined segment, which we have called transparency, cooperation, and participation in preliminary examination with seven committed papers. So it looks at the interaction of preliminary examination with outside actors and the possibility of outside actors to see into, to look into, and understand ongoing preliminary examinations. And finally, we have a cluster called thematicity in preliminary examinations with five committed papers where we look at themes such as sexual violence, children, and other themes. Now, this taxonomy does not entirely correspond to what Professor Carsten Stahn and I had in mind. There is a gap between our preconceptions and what is coming out of this process of communitarian scholarship. We have modified our original preconceived taxonomy in light of the overall picture that has emerged through the responses to the call for papers. And indeed, there has been many more responses than we have been able to accept. We have had to turn down quite a number of qualified paper proposals. So I mention this because the project tries to follow the idea of communitarian scholarship, which we have practiced through a number of the projects which Judge Liu kindly referred to in his introductory remarks. And this approach is characterized by a number of features, such as, and I've listed them here, a prolonged internal analysis to identify and define the topic. And as it turns out, Carsten, if I may use your first name in this setting, had been thinking about preliminary examination for many years and had been talking with several scholars, and we held a meeting in this very room in the fall of 2015 that looked at some aspects of preliminary examination from his work and analysis. And I had also for many years considered doing a conference and a book on quality control in preliminary examination. But we came from two slightly different but complementary perspectives, and we needed in the first phase to harmonize our approaches into a common project. And secondly, we have to develop a concept note, which we did. And thirdly, form a project team and not only have Leiden and SILRAP and the usual suspects from the Western European and others group, but bring in Chinese institutions, Indian institutions, and others to broaden the discourse space also from the type, the perspective of the project team. And then there was the public call for papers, widely disseminated. SILDROP has more than 47,000 contacts on our circulation list, so when we send out an email with a call for papers, it actually reaches quite far from a statistical point of view. And then is the process of making a mosaic of the pieces that come back, being tuned to the concept note, but open to the community of qualified voices that then becomes constituted. As a next step, there is the preparation of the program. It needs to be detailed, focused, and sharp, but also be short and concise. You have it in front of you. You can judge for yourself. Then there is the process of adjusting the taxonomy during the conference and the editing of papers. There is the copy editing and substantive editing of the common work product. And finally, in our model, there is the publishing on an open access basis of an anthology, both online and an identical manuscript in print, so that if you cite from the online ebook, you will be citing to exactly the same page as if you have the money to buy the printed hard copy version. So the basic ideas behind this approach and this notion of communitarian scholarship is A, more minds may contribute more perspectives and insights than one. And B, the discourse community of international law badly needs to be expanded outside the Western European and others group as soon as possible. And this is a view that I hold more and more firmly the longer time I spend in Beijing teaching at Peking University Law School, which has brilliant students, most of them, if not all of them, smarter than me, but which are shaped by a society that views international law in a fundamentally different way than in Norway, my home country. So what is the cognitive territoriality of our specific project on quality control in preliminary examination? Well, there are two vertical temporal lines here. Prior to the involvement of criminal justice, international or national, and the second one, prior to the commencement of criminal investigation. And in the first phase, there is the emphasis on enhancing fact work outside criminal justice, in particular in the context of human rights documentation or documentation of violations that may amount to core international crimes. This phase of our project is completed. The book Quality Control in Fact Finding is standing on the table over there. I encourage you to have a look at it. What we are doing now is we're looking at pre-investigation, but inside criminal justice, and we are looking at, specifically at questions concerning quality control in the domains of cost efficiency, fairness, predictability, trust in institutions, and also how to reduce the excuses, the bland excuses, to investigate where those exist. This will produce an anthology called Quality Control in Preliminary Examination. And this project will be followed by a project next year that looks at how to enhance performance during the most costly phase, namely that of criminal investigation, analyzing all key aspects of investigation management, methods, and tools, and producing a third volume on quality control in criminal investigation. This is the cover of the book that is already available, perhaps, and of course, Karsten will have to give his opinions. The cover of the next book will look like this. And why have I mounted this image? because both show artists at work. The first show perhaps the most prominent contemporary artist, Mr. Renzo Scarpelli in Italy, putting his signature on a work of Intarsio. This image is that of Alberto Gandolfi, the most prominent restorer of frescoes of his young generation. He's in his early 30s. He's been trained for more than 15 years to restore frescoes and does work in the Vatican and elsewhere in Italy. And here he is checking a fresco of Grotius, Hugo Grotius, in Italy to see which repair needs to be done. From documentation to trial. So these three phases of our commitment to quality control, from fact-finding outside criminal justice to preliminary examination to criminal investigation, it also parallels shrinking domains of discretionary space and at the same time increased technical specialization. The domain of human rights documentation is flooded with discretion and enjoys very limited normative regulation. Pre-investigation has less discretion and more rules-based work processes, and this is what we are looking at in this project. Criminal investigation, significantly less discretion and significantly more regulation. And then at the opposite end of the spectrum, you have trial, appeal, and review, where codes of criminal procedure, where practice directives, where a number of instruments create an environment of very dense normative regulation, and where the spaces for discretion are much more limited. But strangely, that's also the area that by far gets the most attention by our profession. It is the trial and the procedural issues linked to trial and the evidentiary issues that we talk about, that we want to be involved in, that the law journals publish about. This is where there is the attention and the mainstream of the narrative, whereas the fact work that is done in pre-investigation or in human rights documentation or in the margins of trials receives much less attention. And again, strangely enough, the cost ratio is exactly the opposite. Yeah, actually, the cost of the fact work is much higher for states than is the cost of the trial work. So we're giving much more attention to something that is less costly overall, and vice versa. Why the emphasis on quality control? Because all criminal justice actors, I write in this slide, indeed all public agencies need to constantly become more professional in how they spend public funds and fulfill their public mandate. Quality control is used synonymously with professionalization. This approach does not seek to expose or point fingers at specific criminal justice actors. It does not offend or provoke a defensive reaction. Certainly, that is not the intention. Rather, the approach points to a common challenge and therefore creates a language that opens doors for real discussion of real challenges in criminal justice. So what does quality control mean? Well, the term was chosen because it does not have a rigid, exclusive definition. Its precise content should be crystallized through the consideration of specific issues. Some of the draft papers already submitted give more precise meaning to the term when discussing specific issues in those draft papers. And this is exactly the intention of the project. Generally speaking, the notion of quality control refers more to an organizational culture or awareness than to specific measures. It entails constant questioning of the quality of work processes and their results by individuals and organizations. The third volume on criminal investigation will elaborate the approach more generally and in greater detail based on what has been developed in the three research projects. Quality control is a challenge to all criminal justice actors, but it does indeed make a difference when the criminal justice leader meets one or more of the following six qualities. When he or she has a strong grasp of details of work processes in his or her jurisdiction, not limited to facts and law in the open case files, but also concerning the overall management, spending of money, and the socio-political context, what is possible at any given moment. I can tell you I was legal advisor to Richard Goldstone, to Luis Arbor, to Carla Del Ponte, and to Luis Moreno Ocampo, and there is huge difference between them. And when I left The Hague and joined the chief prosecutor of Norway's office for a period as special advisor, I can tell you there is again huge difference between international chief prosecutors and national chief prosecutors. It struck me when I came to Oslo that the Norwegian chief prosecutor, who had then had for a total of 22, 23 years been either deputy chief prosecutor or chief prosecutor, he had an unbelievable grasp of what was happening inside the Norwegian prosecution service. And he would make the point at least once a year to sit down with every prosecution office in his jurisdiction, face to face, if necessary, for a whole day. And he would go through all the issues and demonstrate to his subordinates his command of the issues. This does something to the culture of an organization. Yeah. Second point I mention is when the leader projects a distinctly conscientious approach, never cutting corners or compromising standards, but being intellectually thorough, which is not necessarily the same as being very thorough and working slowly. Yeah. This makes a difference. You set a standard from the top of the organization. Thirdly, when the leader selects independent-minded staff and is seen to associate closely with those independent-minded staff and to always protect them in their independence, not to punish them for their being independent and critical, but to reward them to go to lunch with those who actually contradict you in meetings with many persons present. To take out for dinner in front of the staff the person who had the courage to say, "You're wrong, Mr. Prosecutor. If you do this, I will resign." Yeah. And indeed, this is what Goldstone did to a very large extent when he established the ICTY Office of the Prosecutor. He hired senior prosecutors and made the point of showing support to those who challenged him on specific issues. And it did something to the culture of the organization. When the leader encourages a questioning attitude at all levels of the organization, it makes a difference. Well, it means you will have young women and men who are 28 and they just graduated, and they will raise their hand in the meeting with the chief prosecutor, and they will say, "Did you think of this and did you think of that?" Which in some cultural context would be offensive, because deference is expected of those who are younger and less experienced. But actually, that's exactly what fosters a culture of quality control inside an organization, that you allow that and you encourage that. That kind of involvement, critical involvement. When the leader institutionalizes peer review in all important internal decision-making processes involving all relevant staff, If you're going to go forward with an important motion, well, you circulate this several days in advance to all the lawyers in the office, and you call a general meeting where any lawyer in the office can come and challenge the draft. You don't call a meeting of two or three persons to protect the work product of a favored staff member. This is not the way one creates an organization that is permeated by a sense of quality control. Yeah? And finally, when the leader subjects all important management questions to daily regular senior staff briefing with open exchanges, well, that again has a big impact on the organization. And this was also something prosecutors at the ICTY Office of the Prosecutor persuaded the first ICTY prosecutor to institutionalize, to have a senior staff briefing every morning at about 9:05, where all the management questions on the agenda of the chief prosecutor would be briefed. And anyone can take the floor and challenge the direction so that there is not big things happening for the whole office, which lawyers, those who actually have to stand up in court and defend cases, have no input on before the decisions have been made. Yeah. So it does matter how is the leader of a prosecution agency. But that doesn't mean that we can abdicate on questions of quality control. They concern all of us, even if our position is on a much lower level of the organization. I end with a reflection which maybe points more to Karsten's deeper and more penetrating observations. Pre-investigation or preliminary examination has a center and a periphery. And we may not entirely agree what is the center, but I think that one can agree that there is a center and there is a periphery based on the mandate, based on the statute, based on the law of the criminal justice agency in question. And perhaps one possible general formulation of the center is that pre-investigation is a process and not an end in itself to determine whether to open a criminal investigation against the standard which could be reasonable basis to proceed to an investigation or something equivalent. And around that will grow, for sure, ulterior or secondary use of pre-investigation. And that raises questions depending on the direction of practice. And some of these questions we will discuss here today, tomorrow, and in the chapters in the book. Can a drive to appear even-handed on the part of a prosecution service prolong or otherwise affect preliminary examinations? Well, this would seem to be a peripheral motivation or thought or concern, but it could take center stage in some situations because you have done A and you want to show some constituencies that you are also doing B because you are even-handed, you are objective. We ask for the transfer of President Bashir, but we are also doing a preliminary examination of the Israelis, the darlings of the West in the Middle East. We are even-handed. And we are going to continue to be even-handed for more than 3 years to show to everyone that we are really even-handed. Yeah? Is it possible? Is it possible that this thought existed in the minds of some? If so, the idea would be that this is a peripheral understanding of preliminary examination, and it does raise questions, and some of them are serious. Can use of the speed of preliminary examination with a view to deter have unintended consequences? We will keep this open because it puts a pressure on the parties to the conflict in that country. And we will keep it open for years. Although the specific incidents that are before us in the preliminary examination are rather focused and narrowed and could be dealt with in 2 months, we will nevertheless keep it open because the existence of an open preliminary examination has a deterrent effect. So we believe. Yeah. Again, a peripheral function of preliminary examination, which raises questions. Finally, and these are just examples, of course, which interests are in the shadow of preliminary examination? If you do keep a preliminary examination open, who pays the price? The Norwegian company Kvaerner at one stage bought the British company Trafalgar House, which had earlier contracts to sell lighting systems and barbed wire and sound systems to the United States Army in Guantanamo Bay. And Trafalgar House became the company that provided the infrastructure for the alleged torture by use of sound and light in Guantanamo Bay detention facility. And Kvaerner claimed that they didn't know this when they bought the company, but they didn't cancel the contracts with the United States Army, and they became the mother company of a daughter company that continued to provide these services when the alleged torture hit the media. Keeping the preliminary examination of the allegations against Kvaerner open would come at the cost or at the price. For whom? Keeping the preliminary examination against Israelis for alleged conduct in Gaza over 3 years would come at the price. For whom? Well, for the owners of Kvaerner and for the Israeli government. Yeah, those would be two examples. Is this problematic? If one engages in peripheral use of preliminary examination or pre-investigation, what is one's obligation for those who are affected by the shadow of that exercise? I have taken more time than I had planned to. These were my introductory remarks. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.